Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
How you doing, Internet? It's me, Danielle. I'm here live from Lobby One with Waypoint Radio, and I'm not really hosting because Austin's really
I'm
here.
Right, it's here.
Just, I'm in Lobby One. You know, I felt like I had to do the "How you doing, Internet." I can't say what's good because I'm not you. So
yeah,
you know,
that's fair. That's fair.
I'm trying to be fair. I'm trying to be equitable here on April 7th. I had to look.
You have to look at the day. This is what I'm saying. You got. I hand over hosting for one day, and you almost forget the date. Not like me, who always gets the date right.
You always get the date right, you know.
Who's always prepared.
We need to go check the evidence on that one, please.
No, there is none.
Dear listener.
I don't know about
podcasting
that.
Podcasting is an ephemeral art form, and I'm logging into our Libsyn account to delete everything.
Yep, it is ephemeral. It is very ephemeral. Well, joining me today, obviously, is Austin Walker.
How's it going?
And Patrick Klepek.
I showed up.
Yeah.
You showed up. You're doing good. You're ahead of the game at this point.
I'm always behind the game, but if you want to describe it that way, that's fine. I'll accept it.
That's fine. Austin, you can actually host.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
I just had to say the "how you doing, Internet," you know? Uh-huh.
You're trying
it's
to get
fine.
This new, different catchphrase through. I got you. How you doing, Internet?
I'm not trying to get the catchphrase through.
I just
can't emulate your catchphrase.
Push the brand.
I cannot do it justice. You know what I'm saying?
I do know that Austin or I are capable of emulating the DK rap, but from what I understand, Danielle, you said you would produce 40% of the DK rap for us.
Which
today.
40?
That's correct.
Is it 40 concurrent or is it 40 like...
It's just 40,
do we have to 40%
pieces from the rap?
Yeah.
Bits and pieces. So there's, of course, Donkey Kong's verse, which is, "His coconut gun fires in spurts. If he shoots ya, it's gonna hurt."
Doesn't... Okay.
And there's the verse. It's like, DK, Donkey Kong, DK,
wait,
Donkey
his
Kong
verse
is here.
Wait. His verse is those two lines? He doesn't even have 8 bars?
I mean, there's more. I told you I only know 40%. Okay. I was trying to be honest about this. And then there's Lanky Kong, which is, "He has no style. He has no grace. This Kong has a funny face. DK. Donkey Kong." Told you, 40%.
I'm over here on the rapgenius.com, genius.com,
oh,
DK rap bit here. This there's an annotator here who notes on the there's the line, "As we take you through this monkey rap," and this genius has added, "This rap is about monkeys, or more specifically, 3 gorillas, 2 chimpanzees, and an orangutan."
Right. Lanky Kong is the orangutan of the group. This is important for you to know about Donkey Kong 64. One of the not amazing 3D platformers of the N64
era. Bad game.
Seriously want to read a book about that, because most of those platformers were fantastic and they hold up pretty well. Honestly, I went back and I played Rare Replay not that long ago. Banjo-Kazooie is fantastic. I played through the entire thing recently. Banjo-Tooie is very good. I think it did some really cool things with adventure game design. And this all wraps into a really great segue, which is the fact that, Patrick, I know you've been playing a lot of ukulele.
Wait, stop, pause. We hold on to ukulele.
I made that work, Austin. I don't know.
You didn't, because there's something important I need to get out there that I said before we started.
Austin interrupts your, like, I don't know what's going on. This podcast has now made me deeply uncomfortable. I don't, like, your great segue got killed. What do you have to say,
segue.
Austin?
It was a great segue, but listen.
The weight of what you're about to say. Okay,
I like birds. I just don't like pet birds. Monday's podcast, I made the claim that I didn't like birds. We're talking about dogs and cats. We were having a good conversation. And then I mentioned that I don't like birds. And people on the internet were very upset at me because people like birds. And I get it. People like birds. but I don't like just pet birds. I bring this up because I have like this very vivid memory of being young Austin and having my mom complain about the birds in the yard. We had this like nice yard. We moved into a house eventually. Like we eventually were able to move into a house. It was great. And there were birds and she hated it because the birds were loud and woke her up. And mm-hmm. I loved waking up to the sound of birds. And I like birds in general. I like how there are birds out in the world. I like hearing them. I like seeing them.
They
I just
fly.
Don't want
it's
them in
nice.
My house. And I just needed to clarify that before we move on to talk about video games.
This seems like backpedaling. This feels
it's
like
not,
Big Bird has come in and pressured Austin to change his position. The goalposts are moving,
no,
Austin.
No. In fact, fuck people who have pet birds. That's what I'm saying. The thing is, honestly...
How do you feel about Big Bird?
Big Bird gets to go wherever Big Bird wants. In fact, Big Bird went missing once, and people have to go look for him. And here's the thing. Let
it's
Big Bird
movie.
Go missing. Big Bird goes to wherever the fuck he wants. He's a bird. Let him fly away.
That's true.
I have
it's
a hard time looking at birds in cages. Is the real fucking... If we, like, get into my, like, brain real quick, if we're going to psychoanalyze
me... Do you know why it sings?
It's upsetting to see birds in cages, because I know what they're capable of. And that's such a small space.
So you hold that against the birds?
No,
you just hate people.
I hate people who have. I dislike people who have pet birds. I don't dislike them. I dislike that they have pet birds. I have a hard time with pet birds.
All right,
that's
okay.
What I'm
struggle.
Saying.
Donkey Kong has a pet bird named Squawk.
So here's an example. I like geese. Lots of people hate geese because they're shitty and mean, and they are.
They're literally shitty. That's
right. But guess what? Dog like sometimes
truth.
Geese have to go places. Like I don't need to. I don't need to define my relationship to birds based on how well they fit into my life. Like, guess what? Lions will also fuck you up. I still like lions. I just stay the fuck away from them.
It's
geese are like lions.
Okay, lions are pretty good. All right, we're good with lions. Patrick's not good with lions, though.
Patrick's good with dinosaurs, which are basically birds.
Just to keep track of everything.
Hey,
you
that's
know, in
hey,
terms
Austin,
of
that's
who
its,
likes
that's
what
its own
animal.
Separate conversation. The science is not settled on.
Wait, is it not?
I found this blog on the internet that said the science is not settled, and so that is not a consensus, and so. I'm sticking with it. Doesn't mean dinosaurs are birds. That's fine.
Are you a bird truther?
I believe in the truth.
I've never seen a dinosaur.
Gotten to him yet.
I've never seen a dinosaur and a bird in the same place. I mean,
yeah, I've never seen a dinosaur with feathers. Have you?
Images.
Pictures?
Not pictures. Not photos.
I've seen a few shops in my time.
Photographs.
Austin.
You know.
You know those pixels. You can see the pixels. Yeah.
I can see them. Yeah.
You can see those.
I know how the moon Literally. Landing works. Come on.
All right.
It's true.
Apologies for stepping all over your segue, but I said
hey,
before
right.
we started, I had to get this off my chest right away. Because it's been burning. It's been burning inside of me.
You had to get it off your chest, and now do you feel light like a bird? You feel like you could fly away?
No, because I'm stuck in this feel? Podcast for the next 50 minutes.
Yeah. Well,
so no.
This podcast without a good segue now.
I could get to. We could get back to a good segue. If we want to keep riffing, I promise we'll get back.
Well, all right. One half of the duo
right.
of ukulele is a bat. Uh-huh. Which is it? Not a bird, but it is a flying creature, a small flying creature. So, dinosaur
no,
means
here you
terrible
go. Ready?
Lizard. There's a lizard in it, too.
The thing that I like, the reason that I don't like birds in cages is because I have such a clear image of them flying vertically, flying up into the air, far away from things. They have so much mobility, so much freedom. And Danielle, all week, all you've been saying to me is, I wish I liked ukulele, but it doesn't have the verticality of Banjo-Kazooie. It doesn't have the freedom
exactly
of movement.
It. That's exactly it. See, now you did it.
There we
that's,
go.
That's perfect
and, we're
and
back.
Beautiful. I have been playing a lot of ukulele. I'm not as far in as I want to be because I keep not, I don't know. It's like I'll play for a while and then I just have to put it down because I'm so upset. I will preface this by saying I'm probably the world's, like, biggest Banjo-Kazooie fan, like, ever. I made a video at Polygon about how I think Banjo-Kazooie is actually better than Mario 64. I think it has incredible level design. It has adventure game inspired puzzles. It has a lot of things. It's doing different things. And I will also say I also love Mario 64 dearly. And it came out before it. It is a more important game. It was the more revolutionary game. It's just Banjo-Kazooie took that and did some things a little different with it. That's all. That was my argument there and will be my argument
what,
now.
Wait, what sort of things did it do differently? Because like, so I'm someone who
so
never
again,
played those games.
Okay, so in Mario 64 you start out with the same moveset. It's beautiful, it's rich, it's wonderful, the level design supports it. But in Banjo-Kazooie, you learn moves sort of as you go. And you actually get more and more powerful sort of as you go. My biggest thing that I actually really love about it, I like that design paradigm, I think you could do good things with both. What I love the most about Banjo-Kazooie is that it becomes basically an adventure game by the end. You're actually sort of solving puzzles that are very adventure game design inspired. There's a world at the very, very end that has four seasons. You have to do things in one season that will carry over into the other seasons. I really like that. I like that sort of continuity. I like that sort of storytelling. You know, it's not really like explicit storytelling, but it's this kind of living world that's evoked much better through that kind of design. And the levels had an incredible verticality to them. Some of the levels were incredibly tall. They're deep. They're interesting. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of nooks and crannies. It's fun and exciting. And again, I say this having played it again fairly recently.
Right.
This is not me being
pure
like,
nostalgia
when talking. I was 14, it was great. And now it kind of sucks. No, I actually think it's a very, very good 3D platformer. And Banjo-Tooie, I promise I'll make this quick, but the sequel was maybe not quite as purely great platformer, but it really leaned into that sort of adventure game design. Things you did in one world carried over into other worlds.
I had a friend tell me about the stop and swap stuff.
They intended to have actions that you took in Banjo-Kazooie influence and unlock stuff in Banjo-Tooie, and there was going to be a whole way it worked. And they actually made it work in the Xbox Live Arcade release.
Oh, did
presumably
they?
In the Rare replay release. So they I believe that's true. I believe it's true that they actually managed to make good on the connective tissue between those two games in the re-release as opposed to the N64 one, which became like the subject of lots of conspiracy theories when I was younger of like, well, actually there is a way for you to like connect these two games if you do a certain thing and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. But it never actually, because I was obsessed with that as a kid, was the idea, like it was just such a cool concept. Like the idea that you could do something in the first game and have that unlock stuff in the second game,
right?
But it just never happened, and I'm not sure why exactly. I'm sure I knew at some point, but I don't remember what the.
It had to do with the cartridge swapping itself. Like you had to, the way it was going to work was you had Banjo-Kazooie in your N64. You had to kind of grab it out and within 30 seconds put Banjo-Tooie back in, but that was actually destructive to the actual hardware. These are physical cartridges, so they couldn't end up doing it. But it was that idea, like it would be in the system memory for 30 seconds or whatever, and then you could do the thing.
The thing my friend AJ, shout out to AJ, was telling me literally last night about this was that Nintendo was like, no, you can't do that, like that's dangerous, like
you're gonna break it.
Yeah, so thanks Nintendo.
Yeah, so that was my very long preface to my feelings about Yooka-Laylee, which I think is important to have in context because I was primed and ready. 3D platformers are probably my favorite kind of game ever out of everything. Maybe 2D platformers, give it, you know, ask me on what day. But platformers are my thing. Mm-hmm. They are the type of game I love to play. They're interesting to me. They're fun to me. I get a lot of joy from jumping, but also from like interacting with big, weird worlds that have a lot of nooks and crannies and stuff to explore. Yooka-Laylee sounds like a Banjo-Kazooie game in every way, good and bad. The music is amazing and dynamic and beautiful. It has the sound effects when people are talking, the like boop, 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 the whole deal with that. But it does not feel or play like Banjo-Kazooie. It feels stiff. The camera is a constant annoyance. And the biggest indictment so far, at least, you know, sort of from my playtime with it, is that the levels feel flat. They feel like Skylanders levels, which are not really pure platformers. Those are honestly more sort of combat games that happen to have wider worlds. There's not that much jumping, to be honest, in like a Skylanders game. But this is without any of kind of the combat or interesting things about Skylanders. So it's kind of literally falling flat for me. And I know, Patrick, you have been playing it as well. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I played like the first 90 minutes. Like, I am not going to touch your Mario 64 versus Banjo-Kazooie argument with a 10-foot pole, but I will say that
Wait a second.
No, I distinctly remember being annoyed about this argument and never knew you were the one that was the one peddling it over Polygon.
Fault.
But
it was
100%
my fault.
We're just going to leave that be. We're going to leave that be. Right. Because right. I was a huge Mario 64 fan and also a huge Banjo-Kazooie fan, and for all the same reasons that you're talking about, like the expansiveness of the world was very was a huge part of the appeal. Is that every time you went into a new area, it was just like awe-inspiring for how much you could explore and how much you were rewarded for kind of poking around, as opposed to Mario 64, which are much more sort of directed, goal-oriented experience. Even if that took place in areas that felt wide, it was actually kind of narrow in terms of what you were accomplishing as the player. And Yeah, ukulele does absolutely nothing for me. Like, I think it is a pale, boring imitation of these games. I think it feels like you're reanimating a corpse, like a Frankenstein, but with, like, none of the actual, like, liveliness and fun and joy that I got out of the Banjo-Kazooie games. Like, it just feels incredibly forced in a way that has made it a slog to play. And not even that, I just think fundamentally as a game, like, it's poorly designed. Like, the goals that are present in it, it's very unclear what you're supposed to even do in the game a lot of the time. Like, for example, you'll constantly unlock routes to, you know, you're trying to collect these pages, and these pages will either allow you to do one of two things. They allow you to enter into brand new worlds, or they allow you to expand the worlds that you're currently in, which is kind of an interesting idea in concept. I would have preferred the worlds were just fully unlocked to begin with, and so you could just explore at your own leisure these giant spaces, as opposed to being told, like, hey, come back when you've gotten some pages and this world will be larger. But
yeah.
Even that, all that said, like, there are sections in the game that I found where I've clearly run into sort of like a puzzle or a combat area or some sort of thing that will allow me to get a page, but it's not clear if I'm even capable of accomplishing the task. Because one of the things this game does is that it has you buying move sets from a vendor, and so
by the way, is Trouser
the Snake.
Trouser the Snake.
Trouser Snake.
Yep. And Trouser, so, like, you know, I've had multiple sections where it's unclear to me if I'm just in, I have not figured out what to do, or I don't have the move to actually accomplish the task, and the game does very little to communicate whether you should, you know, it doesn't, like, you know, there's not like a creature comes up to you at the beginning and says, hey, buddy, like, make sure you've got, like, this, or else you're not going to be able to do this. Like, instead, I end up wasting 20 minutes futzing around with something, not knowing if I'm actually able to accomplish it.
Is it just a list of moves you could buy in whatever order you want, or is it, like, one at a time?
Yes.
How would you know which ones would help you unlock different areas?
Well, I mean, like, it communicates that. Like, for example, like, the first sets of moves you can buy, like, one is sort of like a butt stomp equivalent, and, like, right next to the vendor are these rocks that clearly have some cracks in them, and then you can butt stomp them. Like, that's usually how games communicate that, but it's usually because they're doling out the moves to you in a very specific way, which is that it is granted to you as a gatekeeping device, and then here's a demonstration of how you use it so you can go back into the world and apply that to maybe areas you were in before. But I'm constantly finding that I'm discovering things and not knowing if there's anything I can do with, like, there's one section, for example, where you clearly have to aim at these very specific targets, but they're not, like, level with you, so you can't, you know, when you first unlock the ability to fire, you can shoot in front of you, and you can, you know, change the direction of the character to change that on a horizontal level, but these shots are clearly on a vertical scale, but I don't believe the ability to, like, freeform shoot, or is that something that I can unlock, or am I supposed to, like, do trick jumps in order to, like, change the verticality so I can't, like, the game doesn't communicate at all whether I'm just not putting it together, or I don't have a thing that I have to unlock three worlds from now,
right,
then come back. Because that's a thing that would make sense, that, hey, come back with some other moves, and then you're able to discover new parts of this world. But I've just found it lifeless, frustrating, and as someone that really enjoyed those games, it contrasts in a really strange way to another game I played 90 minutes of, Thimbleweed Park, which does, like, a much better job of, like, adapting an older style of game.
Can you set that up a little bit? Thimbleweed Park is
Ron Gilbert, who is one of the co-creators of Monkey Island, worked on a lot of, you know, LucasArts games, Maniac Mansion, and he had set off and did a Kickstarter for his own brand new adventure game called Thimbleweed Park, which takes place in, like, this sort of weird, odd town, and these two detectives come in to investigate a murder. And the setup of the game is the very Scum style old school adventure game where you're using specific verbs to interact with the world. So look at, pick up, pull, he's made just another one of those style of games, but made it in 2017, and it works from what I played so far, about the same in both games. A hell of a lot better than my experience in Yooka-Laylee, which is disheartening.
What do you think makes that work specifically? And Danielle, have you checked out Thimbleweed at all?
I know not yet. It's on curious. My list. I think I have a code, so it's gonna happen. But yeah, Patrick, what is working for you in that?
It's difficult to tell. Like I don't know if I could put my thumb on why Thimbleweed Park is working for me versus the Yooka-Laylee. Like you said you went back and you played Banjo-Kazooie and Banjo-Tooie and it holds up for you, whereas like my initial thought would be, well, maybe just that game design just doesn't work as well in 2017. So it is possible, you know, it's interesting where I think it's possible I could go back and play Banjo-Kazooie and kind of go, eh, I just don't know if I want to play this style of game anymore. Right. Whereas you clearly have played that style of game recently, reaffirmed that you do like it, and so then there are reasons that Yooka-Laylee is falling flat for you that are different than what would be my first theory on this, which is that, well, it's just the traditional adventure scum style setup just holds up better in 2017. Also, I would potentially posit that Thimbleweed Park learns certain lessons of game design from then to now that I don't think Yooka-Laylee necessarily applies. Like, just because you're adopting an older style of game premise, like setup, doesn't mean that you can't learn a lot from what's happened. And it may be the case, and I'm also limited because of the amount of time I spent with both, but I might be able to suppose that Thimbleweed Park does a better job of learning lessons of streamlining and adapting an older style of game to the modern era than Yooka-Laylee did itself.
Part of that is, you know, maybe I am actually completely wrong here, but a thing I hear a lot is like, oh, the death of the adventure game. But the adventure game actually didn't go, like, there was definitely less big budget, like, huge prestige adventure games as there were in the 90s, but, like, people kept making adventure games over the last 15 years. Some of them were really great. They went to new platforms. The DS was a great home for adventure games. The rise of like the sort of like middle ground of like visual novel meets adventure game in the West, people started playing those. Games like 80 Days shifted things and other sorts of like interactive text adventures, sorcery, all sorts of things that like, okay, this has like adventure game elements, but there's other things happening. So there's a lot to learn from in that space. Whereas like when I think of major platformers that have come out in that time, Mario Galaxy 1 and 2, Captain Toad.
Hell yeah, Captain Toad.
That's exactly...
The Mario Land, the Mario 3D Land games.
I honestly think Breath of the Wild is an amazing... It has amazing platforming elements.
Totally.
It is incredibly fun to traverse the world. Right. It's fun to jump. It's fun to climb. It's fun to use your paragliding. I think 3D platformers can be done beautifully and wonderfully, and Captain Toad is maybe one of my favorite Wii U games, honestly.
Right,
yeah.
It's great. It's a 3D platformer that doesn't use jumping. It uses other types of traversal. It uses more camera setups. It uses all this other stuff. But you're essentially traversing and solving puzzles. You're doing the things you do in a 3D platformer in that game.
I guess I'm curious, like, am I completely off base in feeling like part of the thing here is that, you know, the team that made Thimbleweed Park got to look at a wide range of adventure games and say, okay, what did they do right? How did they streamline? Whereas I'm curious if the folks behind Yooka-Laylee, is it true that they had enough material even to look at and say, okay, here's how the 3D platformer has been streamlined and modernized, or has there just been a lack of that stuff to begin with? All right, I guess another question is, what's a 3D platformer, or what is another 3D platformer besides the ones that I've mentioned that has been getting it right? Or is that it?
I mean, I think you mentioned a lot of them. Okay. There aren't many 3D platformers right now. There's certainly games, I mean, even something like Crackdown obviously has platforming elements. There's a lot of games that have, like, borrowed 3D platforming elements. Even the Metroid Prime series had platforming elements to it. It's not a platformer per se. I think the thing is, and I think this is the biggest problem, even if they really remade a good, solid Banjo-like, you know, with that level design on that, like, to that degree, doing the things that went so, so well for Banjo-Kazooie, I would still love it, even if it had some of the quirks of the old design. I think that design can hold up. It's just a question of this level design, the way the moveset is arranged, the way things are organized, just isn't good. I don't think it's a well-crafted 3D platformer. For me, at least, I don't think the 3D platformer is like an old, dated, like crappy design paradigm. This just isn't a good version of it.
Well, also key to any platformer is the fluidity of movement, right? Like platforming is rooted in, it is enjoyable as the player to run around in a world. Like if you don't nail that part, then you know, a lot of the other, you know, no matter what you do with the rest of the structure, it's going to have a hard time clicking. And I'm not enjoying running around in Yooka-Laylee. Like the actual traversal elements of that game, I find to be troublesome. A part of that is the camera. The camera is a real problem, impediment in that game. But cameras weren't great in the N64 era either.
That's absolutely true.
But there was something to the movement of Mario, of Banjo. Like there was a, and it's not just the running around. It's how it all clicks. It's the jumping. Yeah. It's the double jumping. It's how you're connecting moves to extend the platforming. It's how you're gliding around, which is a key part of Yooka-Laylee. It's a key part of Banjo Kazooie. And so I don't think that stuff works particularly well. It doesn't feel it feels stiff in a way that it doesn't work for me in 2017. I think like if you go back and play Banjo-Kazooie, yes, it still feels a little stiff, but it's also a product of its time, and so you're able to kind of look past that and contextualize that game as it was. And I don't consider that to be a fault of the game as much as that's what that game is from that time. When I play a game that looks like that, but then feels like that in 2017, a modern game, that's a harder hill to climb. And also, there are certain elements of those games that I just don't have the patience for anymore. Like when I started Yooka-Laylee, and one of the first menu prompts you get is you collect a little feather and it says, "Hey buddy, there are 200 of these in each world." And then I wanted to place my face in a bucket and just move on from this world, because the idea of like collecting 200 of these in each world, like I understand, like part of putting collectibles in these games serves a very specific purpose, which is to encourage exploration and to have the player find those nooks and crannies. Yeah. There are ways for collectibles to be effective as a device to incentivize the player to explore in ways they might not necessarily do on their own. But like when I saw that number, it gave me the flashbacks to games like Donkey Kong 64. Like that was Donkey Kong 64 is like, it had a lot of other flaws, but like one of its biggest flaws was that it was the apex of collectathon, when it was just like, you know what makes a game good? Collecting 300 things. Yeah. It's like, no, like that's not what makes these games good. And that's like that's a lesson that I want. Like, you know, when you play Mario Galaxy or 3D Land or 3D World, there are collectibles, but those collectibles are incentivization to do specific tasks, to play the game in a certain way. Not they are not just something to give you filler in order to kind of gate you from doing certain things. And like to that end, I'm fairly confident at this point I'm not going to make it to the end of Yooka-Laylee, just because there are so many games.
There's a different
year where, even though this game isn't clicking with me, you know, when I've advocated in the past for playing, you know, mediocre or flawed games, this is kind of the exact sort of game I would like to sit and dissect and spend more time with to better understand why it doesn't work for me. I just don't think 2017 is the year that I can, or at least this point in 2017, I can find the time for that. But yeah, I don't know. I mostly it bums me out.
It might be increasingly true that we don't have the time to play mediocre games, because there are so many good ones. Generally, this year especially, right now, we've had a really great run of big budget AAA games that are all like, many of which are really fantastic or at least deeply interesting. But like, there's something new on Steam every week. If I can dig through it, and I can find something that is worth my time every day. And that is new. Like that is that has been a change in terms of accessible, you know, easy to find good games, in a way that like 3 years ago I probably couldn't necessarily do. There did feel like there were dry spells 3 years ago, and there are still dry spells of big games now, but like I don't know, like there's so much
this month we're gonna have you know, Flint Hook comes out in a couple of weeks, which I don't know if it's good, but the demo I played was fantastic, so hopefully the whole game is good.
Signal of Tolva is about to come out, which we've had on the show a couple times. Like there's all sorts of little stuff that is really interesting, and like sorry games that are like kind of I just don't know that I have the time
I know,
for you
I know.
anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry, sorry, I don't have time for you, man.
It's tough because I do respect the notion of, like, I want to dip my toes into something that I don't think is great. I mean, what the fuck am I talking about? I just beat Mass Effect Andromeda, which is a game I did not like that much at all.
I was going to say, Austin,
ukulele's maybe 10 hours of your time as opposed to Mass Effect Andromeda, which was 70 hours of your time. You know how many bad 10-hour games you could have played?
I know.
Seven of them.
I've been playing Gear. Speaking of good games.
I was going to say, bite your tongue, Austin Walker.
No. I'm in Route C. It's near minute. Welcome to the near minute.
Near minute.
Yo, that game, it feels like that game just started, Patrick.
Yes. Route B is when your eyes begin to widen. It's like that meme about your, whatever they call that meme, where your brain is slowly exploding as you learn new things.
Yeah,
four minds. Yes. Like you are on the third mind.
I'm right there.
And you're on your way.
What's interesting about that game, if I can just briefly hijack this, if I can hack into this conversation.
You can hack right in, Austin.
I was talking to a friend about this, who is a game critic and academic, who was like, I'm like 6-7 hours in, and I see what this game is doing. I get it, blah, blah, blah. And this is not like an uncommon thing, the sort of like, no, you have to at least get to ending B. Like, that's the sort of thing. But I have a different, the way I ended up pitching it to him was this, which is, I said, like, listen, Frank, you and me, we both have a history with character action games. We both have a history with stories about robots and sad robots, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Like, none of this is new for us. But what Nier does is it uses its first two routes to introduce new people to a lot of these concepts that lots of games and movies and short stories and books mm-hmm. have explored about, like, robots and consciousness and machine consciousness and what counts as human. All that stuff in the first 24 hours or so of the game. 20 hours, I don't know. I did a lot of the sides. I did all the side stuff I could.
Yeah, so did I.
It says, hey, if you don't know these conventions already, guess what? We're going to give you a pretty cool, fun, like, romp through those things again. Here's a sad robot. Here is questions about what counts as human. Here is, you know,
it's
questions
like, yeah, it's
about
like if you
culture.
Haven't been, like, you know, reading Philip K. Dick
right.
and, like, are well versed in, like, the critical dissection of Blade Runner.
Exactly.
Which that's a lot of people aren't. Like,
a lot of people are
vaguely aware of sci-fi tropes.
Totally.
But haven't seen them displayed in the way that Nier does. It's basically like priming you for
the deep dive that comes in. You know, I'm like partly into the way of C, but even through B, it starts doing it. And so, like, Route B, that is. And so I really like that notion of it. It's like, it is both a 101 and a 102 course, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? It's like a 101
then
an independent study. And, like, that's, like, awesome. Like, that's so good. Like, I want, that's a cool way of doing this. Part of me wishes route A and B were the same route because I want to get into the, but that's just because I know I'm familiar with this stuff already. I do want to just jump into Route C.
There is a way that the game could have been streamlined, but I also, you know, people have heard me time and time again rail against games for wasting their time. I do think the time, like, there are ways that they could have streamlined the routes A and B together in some way, but I think there's also an argument to be made for where the game ultimately goes for really being methodical
and spending time with those characters.
And, like, the fact that you are retreading certain things is purposeful and meaningful for understanding the scope of where it ultimately goes.
Mm-hmm.
So while I think there are ways it could have been improved, I also, you know, I don't think this is a game that is it's not filler. Like, even if it could have been done better, I think the approach they took was with the intent of making sure you are fully prepared for what it ultimately wants to do and talk about that wouldn't be possible if it was, you know, too streamlined.
Right. Yeah, I'm very happy with it so far. I'm excited to get into the meat, as it were. We have to have a spoiler cast once I'm done. I'm going to try to get through it maybe this weekend, and then we can do a special thing.
Good.
Because it's really special. It's really a special, weird thing. So
I'm glad it's selling well. Like, I'm not usually someone who sort of, you know, gets on the sales train, but I am now on the Yokotaro Express. I want this man to do whatever he wants in the future. And so I was legitimately excited and encouraged by The fact that it seems to have sold a million copies so far, I don't know what their expectations were, but if I have to guess, they were pretty modest. And the fact this game came on Steam was super smart, so that, you know, the game could find a wider audience. And yeah, so even though I'm not usually a salesperson, it's, you know, we always want to encourage, you know, creative folk to get a chance to make the stuff they want to make. And totally. I'm deeply excited that Yoko Taro is finding a wider audience and success. And, you know, clearly he already kind of makes what he wants to make, but maybe that'll be even more the case in the future.
Well, here's hoping that whole team gets to do some cool fucking shit. So
yeah, if that partnership could just keep up, just if right, like Yoko Taro can keep just working keep with Platinum,
it. Totally,
like that would be a dream.
Totally. Do y'all want to go to the bucket?
Let's take a little dip.
What's a number? What's a number? That's Route E, right? That's the final route of
deconstruction of man.
What is a number?
What number did you just give us?
77. Tim is in the room. It's the year the first Star Wars movie came out. I don't know. You know, I was feeling like that. Yeah. Tim Barnes 451 on Twitter.
Hey, Waypointers. Emilio from Puerto Rico here. Here's my question. What game or developer is the Velvet Underground of video games? I'll explain. I remember a few years ago when Lou Reed died, there were many eulogies that stated how influential he and the Velvet Underground were in inspiring other artists and how that would be his legacy more than his individual success as an artist. So basically, what games or developers more recognized for their influence than financial or critical success? I initially thought Far Cry 2 for this honor. What did you think? I love Far Cry 2 a lot. But I don't know that that's where I would jump. I think my answer to this is actually really basic, which is like, it's Mario. It is going to be some of the big games that people grew up with and thought like, oh man,
Doom.
But, yeah, totally. And I think in this next generation, it'll be Minecraft. It's the thing that like not only inspires you to play games, but then to start modding it and thinking about how to make stuff. That's my gut, which is like not as interesting, right? Those answers are not Lou Reed answers, you know? I wish it was.
He's basically trying to argue is like, is there some, you know, obscure indie designer or game that secretly influenced a lot of things people love now? But like, premised in that is that the band never got popular, right? Or like popular in the way that we think about it, and I don't know
that that's. I love Far Cry 2 to death. I know designers who were influenced by Far Cry 2, but most of them were already designers. Right, who are like, like that team made some cool decisions. Like Clint Hawking, cool, he said some smart stuff. Well, I'll integrate that stuff. I don't know, you know, the other analogy that this always reminds me of is like the Pixies, like didn't sell a billion records, but everybody who heard them went on to make a band. And so like that's kind of what I'm thinking in this similarity, but maybe that's not true. Maybe it is just like who influenced other people who are already in this space.
Can we do a looking glass?
Yes,
irrational
right.
thing
that's
here,
actually
maybe
it,
because
right?
that's a closer. Maybe I know, but they're not unsuccessful, you know. But
no, but looking shock. Glass was definitely that's
oh,
that theory.
You know what it is? It's before System Shock. It's Ultima Underworld, right? Which is the first person RPG that includes like that invented mouse look. There wasn't mouse look before Ultima Underworld. Inventing mouse look allows you to start thinking about environmental storytelling, interacting with things in the world that goes beyond.
It was the beginning of the immersive sim, crescendo with Deus Ex. It was essentially Warren Spector.
right. But even there, like, you don't get BioShock without that. You don't get, but you also don't get Far Cry 2. You also, there's all sorts of stuff in that space that is, like, all about, like, oh, right, this is a whole world that I can look around and interact with. I think that.
And I bet a lot of people could coin Mario, not a lot of people could coin Ultima Underworld.
Right.
Sure.
Yes.
Like, a lot of people who love BioShock would point back to as influences would be. Right, like Doom, maybe, right? Like, oh, that's how we got to BioShock. It's like, well, not wrong, but not the actual sort of line is like a clearer path to Ultima Underworld and Thief.
And Deus Ex and System Shocks and all that. Yeah.
I think that's a good answer. I think Ultima Underworld is a good answer.
I think so. There we go. We got something cool. I like that one. I'm happy with that one. It's rare that we get to like a definitive, like, this is the waypoint answer, but... let me
the waypoint definition. The Brooklyn definition of that.
82. My eyes are closed. Danielle, you
82 is good.
Take a look at 82.
All right, I'm going to look at 82. Sorry. I didn't know that was a Danielle look at 82. Yeah. I was Yeah, I'm slow on the uptake here today. 82 is a great number because it was 2 years before I was born. Okay.
Okay. That's one way to judge numbers.
Trying here, okay?
I got
There's
you.
A great, I'm sure Blade Runner came out in 1982. There we go.
Okay.
Hey, I'm trying. I'm working for it. Here it is. This comes from Dylan. Not our Dylan, but another Dylan.
Dylan Coburn, got it.
Dylan writes, "Hey all, some of my favorite memories in video games involve some form of jank. Examples include killing the fight master in World of Warcraft, warping newbies to the end game boss in Ragnarok Online, or exploding a warthog across the map in Halo. Do you think modern games lose out due to their high level of polish?" From Dylan.
I think we still get a lot of janky games.
That's why. Yeah, I think you just got to look on YouTube. And you find plenty of people doing fucked up stuff
and
with
Steam.
Video games in 2017.
There's lots of jank out there right now.
And, like, if anything, it's more enjoyable as fidelity increases and as developers try and put more and more restraints on players, because then when it all breaks, it's like even more glorious. Like Assassin's Creed Unity is a great example of this, when all the faces would fall apart and certain modeling wouldn't kick in and you get this nightmare fuel. As you're playing the game,
and the Beetlejuice eyes and tongue,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's like that's this amazing part where you see this deconstruction of the game, and the jank takes over in a way that clearly would probably didn't make them happy.
I will say that I think we should be generous with Dylan's question, because what it seems like Dylan was really getting at was not like glitchiness, not bugs, like not just no polish, but specifically behavior actions that you can take because of exploits and like gaps in the programming and in the design that let you do things you shouldn't be able to do otherwise. And I still think that the answer,
unintended, there's a term for this, and I can never grasp it when I need to, but like it's not emergent play. There's some term that's associated with this. That's a wonderful term, and I've
failed. You've lost it. That's,
in my duty
that's okay.
To find it,
that's but. Good though. That's fine. But we know what we're talking about, and I think even
we have these days we have more games that like recognize that
and incorporate and encourage
players to actually bend and break, and so it actually like the what used to be breaking the rules has now become like the rules in a certain way. Not for every game, but there's a certain design track that is built around this idea of let the players do whatever they want, and that's the whole point.
Totally.
Yeah, for sure. Do you guys have a favorite type of that thing, or?
It's going to be hard for me not to say Breath of the Wild right now, because it's filled with that stuff, and there's so many stories I have.
But it's a great example. It's a great, it's like, so every day on Twitter, there is something else that someone has done, like the one I saw yesterday, which I'm sure is old news for a lot of people, but where they, managed to construct this craft where they put metal underneath a box, and then they could lift the box with the magnesis tool, and they could just fly themselves everywhere, anywhere
that's
in the world.
Amazing.
And I was like, that's, and that's a great example of what we're talking about, of like, yes, is that what they intended? No. But also yes,
but
it
also
is what
yes.
they intended.
Yeah. But they let you do it. Yeah.
And the only indication you get that you're actually bending their expectations is that when you are doing things like that, the world can't load in properly.
Yes.
So it's like, so you actually are getting a recognition through the game design of the limitations they thought were going to be part, like, right? Like, they would have had more of the world load in if they really thought players are going to be constantly finding ways to subvert it and allow them to fly to the top of the game world. But by actually seeing that hitching, you see concretely where they put in the limitations, which is itself super fascinating to see where the designers themselves thought, okay, this goalpost is fine here. They, will allow them to play within X part of the world and exploit X part of the world, but we're good otherwise to encourage like a smooth player experience. And then immediately when you see stuff like this, you see the limitations they put in place, and then watching the players kind of just walk right past them.
There was a video going around of someone who, by using the paraglider, stamina potions, and bomb arrows, there's a challenge where you have to see how far you can paraglide. And he paraglided for like 11 minutes from the middle, like west of the map,
all the way
across through like the volcano area and back down to Eventide Island. It's and went like 7,000 meters or something, right? Like went 7 kilometers by doing this trick, because he just kept creating updrafts. And that was like part of a little, there's like a mini game where you can do that to get money, right? And he did it, and it went on for 11 minutes, and it zips him back to the guy who runs the minigame. And the guy's like, wow, I've never seen anybody go that far before. Here's 100 rupees. And it's like, oh, you didn't anticipate. There is no, like, super long distance reward for that, because you just never would have guessed that someone would have committed to doing it that way. I'm sure people in that dev team did break the game in interesting ways, and then they had to do the thing of just like, but that's like 1% of 1% of players is going to do this. Fuck them. Yeah. You know, like, let them deal with the load in.
And it is true, but what's also different in the modern era is that it's shared, right? Mm. So jank used to be something you told your friends about, or like, you know, on the playground or, you know, on your BBS board. But these days, it's a Twitter video that gets shared 15,000 times. Like, it's just like, so now, you know.
Which is both a lot and nothing. That's the thing that's crazy about it, right? Is like, that game is going to sell.
It's still a tiny percentage of players.
Exactly. Like, that's the thing that I think about a lot with us, is like, our hyper aware, you know, games sphere is still in a way a little backyard or a little recess, you know, area or whatever. What are those called? What are recess areas called?
Playground.
In academia, we call
those recess areas.
Recess areas.
Play square.
Oh my god!
I'm trying to explore
podcast.
The play space.
Play space.
Yeah, it is play space.
Oh,
right?
That's good. I'm glad we got there.
Mm-hmm. I'm about to go give an academic thing, so I have to get in that mode anyway.
Good.
If you're in New York, you should come to Theorizing the Web. It's happening in like 3 hours. It's happening now, but my panel is in a couple hours. All right, I think that should probably do it for us. Danielle, do you want to take us out since you're hosting?
I mean, you know, I could if you want me to. I don't know. Are you going to kill my segue again?
We'll see what I think about birds. I don't know. Maybe if
you
I
know, are you going to break the beak of my segue? Is that what's going to happen?
That was a reach.
Hey, you know what? The judgment here is really rough, but I'm going to do it. That's going to do it for us, friends who are our friends and not mad at us because we have bad segues. You can, of course, find us online because you're watching us online, obviously. We are at Waypoint on Twitter. We are Waypoint Vice on Facebook. We also have an Instagram. I think that's just Waypoint. Danica knows that one. Maybe it's Waypoint Vice. See, I'm doing such a great job. So where can we find you, Austin Walker, on the internet?
Austin_Walker on Twitter.
Awesome. Patrick, where can we find you?
You can find me at Patrick Klubik. No underscore. I don't those pretenders with the underscore. Not me.
I spent a long time thinking about trying to get Austin Walker or A Walker or A Walk or something. And then like
A Walk.
I used A Walk for a long time as like email addresses and like my Instagram or whatever. She's like A_Walk. Nice. And then, but like those are all taken. And now it's like, well, now I've said Austin_Walker. Tens of thousands of times into microphones. And it just
your
feels
brand.
Right. It's my brand.
Is underscore.
It's true. Same it's my thing. Hacking name.
Sometimes you're underscore. An underscore.
Yeah.
You know.
What about you, Danielle? Where can people find you?
You can find me, Danielle R.I., on Twitter. You can find all of our writing at waypoint.vice.com. And now we're going to do our shout-outs. Tim Barnes, producer and engineer, TimBarnes451 on Twitter. He's an awesome dude, and he loves Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. Dylan Coburn, who is not
personal
on Twitter, is also a really rad dude.
He's also single and looking to mingle.
He also enjoys long walks on the beach and surfing.
It's true. Those are true about
that. Shoutouts to Bowen, who lets us use his beautiful track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can go to waypoint.zone/Bowen for more information on Bowen. For all of us, thank you so much for spending your morning, early afternoon with us. We appreciate you. Have a great weekend. Be safe. Be good or be good at it. Have a wonderful
That's
day.
Good.
You like that?
I do.
Be good or be good at it. It's a good sign off. I like it.
It is.
For the weekend, you know?
I got you. Bye, internet.
We gotta get out of here.